All right, welcome to class today. Glad to see you all here. Since we last met, we have had your in-class quiz number 6 graded and returned to you. You can see that. I believe it has been returned to you. I think I checked that. In general, we did reasonably well. There were some people who, instead of following the proof outline, did something else on problem 1 and got some points, but not all. There are a few people that, instead of proving it had this function relation, instead proved that it terminated, which was the right thing to do on page 2. But that quiz has happened. I don't know that I have significant comments about it. Does anybody have questions about in-class quiz 6? Okay. I will also note that here we are, halfway between quiz 6 and 7, in a class that will have 13 quizzes, thus suggesting we are halfway through the semester. Welcome to the midpoint of your semester. So, today what we're going to do is we're going to do more proof by contradiction primarily. We'll do a little bit more about primes, but mostly we'll do proof by contradiction. We'll also talk about the little ordering principle a bit. Before I get into that though, are there comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? Okay, then let us read. Oh, yes.
Do we have an add class quiz for Monday?
Do we have an
add class quiz?
Yes, you will have an online quiz due, but it won't be due until after spring break.
Okay.
So I will post an online quiz, which instead of having 3 days to do, you will have 10 days to do. Other questions? Okay. Let's just remind ourselves of the basic structure of proof by contradiction. If I can show that not A proves false, then I can conclude A. This is the idea of proof by contradiction. Okay, and as always, when our larger proof contains a smaller proof, we proceed by assuming the left-hand side. So we're going to make this by assuming this, and then we're going to try to derive a contradiction. And that contradiction can take any form we want, so we just need to derive two different things that can contradict each other, that can never both be true. If we do that, we have a full proof by contradiction. Okay? So, we've talked about doing this some with the fundamental theorem of arithmetic. We'll see some more of that today. Proving various things do or do not belong to various sets and so forth. Another tool that will often be useful here goes by the name of the well-ordering principle. This is the subject of chapter 2 of our textbook. Which I've had linked for the last couple of days, and it talks quite a lot about the well-ordering principle. I don't have a lot to add to that conversation. I'm going to add, because I think they do a reasonable job. It's something that the authors of the textbook believe is very important, perhaps even more important than I believe it is. But I'm going to try to just give you the very brief summary of the statement of the well-ordering principle. If S is a subset of the natural numbers, that entails that S has a smallest element. Which, on the surface of it, is sort of like, okay, why do I care? The most common use of the well-ordering principle is to identify a set that you want to be empty. To say, for example, that there are no natural numbers with such and such a property. We define the set of ones that do have the property we think nothing has. And then we show that assuming it has the smallest element leads to a contradiction. So let's start with a little proof of this. We'll come back to some fundamental theorem of arithmetic and some primality ones a little later on. But let's start by trying to prove the following theorem. We are going to try to prove that the sum of I equals 1 to n of I equals n, n plus 1, divided by 2. Now, before I proceed, this notation in theory is something you have all seen before, but in practice I realize some of you either didn't see it or forgot about it. When we write a big sigma like this, this is the math way of writing a loop. There's actually two loop-like structures in math. This is one of them, and we'll see the other one in just a moment. But what we mean by this, this is the formal way of writing 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus n minus 1 plus n. What this is doing is saying loop over all of the integer i's, starting at 1 and going up to n, starting at 1 and going up to n, and for each of them sum. And this is called summation notation, so we're going to sum. The reason we are summing is because we have the sigma symbol, which means to sum. And we're going to sum this function. Okay. In this case, I'm summing the variable itself. I could do fancier things. I could, for example, say I want to sum from I equals, I don't know, how about negative 2 to 2n. I want to sum I squared plus I. This also works in this notation. And this would be the formal way of writing. I want to have minus 2 squared plus minus 2 plus minus 1 squared minus 1 plus minus 1 plus 0 squared plus 0 plus 1 squared plus 1 plus and so on, ending when I get to 2n. So the last one in this will be the 2n squared plus 2n. And I should probably put some parentheses around here for my squaring negatives, because that's not clear. Okay, so this notation is just a loop that adds, a simple accumulator loop in mathematical notation. Before we go into our proof, questions about this notation? Summation notation shows up from time to time when we're doing computing. Often when we're trying to count how many times things happen, we'll talk some more about counting later in the semester and some special forms this function might have, but it will show up from time to time. There is another form, which is a giant pi instead of a giant sigma. And if I were to do that, the giant pi is called the product notation. It means exactly the same thing as the sigma notation, except we're doing multiplications instead. So this would be 1 squared times 2 squared times 3 squared times etc. up to n squared. And so both of these notations occur, summation notation much more often than product notation, but both of them will appear from time to time. And we will come back and talk about some properties of particular sums later in the semester, but I wanted to either review or introduce, depending on whether you remember slash had seen this before, this before we move on. So, happy to take questions about the notation. If there are none, I will jump on and go back to this proof that I wanted to make initially. Any questions about notation before I dive into the proof? Okay, so we're going to try to prove this expression, that the sum from I equals 1 to n of I is n times n plus 1 divided by 2. You actually did a code version of this on the in-class quiz, although we gave you a proof outline using induction. We're going to do it today using contradiction and the well-ordering principle. So let me rewrite my theorem. I equals 1 to n of I equals n. N plus 1 over 2. The idea of how we use the well-ordering principle and contradiction to prove things like this. So I am going to do, we're going to go by contradiction with the well-ordering principle. When I want to use the well-ordered principle, I want to define a subset of the natural numbers. When I want to do it with contradiction, I want to define a subset of the natural numbers for which my theorem does not hold. So what I'm going to say is consider the set of let's call it, how about we'll call it the bad set? The set that is a subset of the natural numbers such that the theorem does not hold for any of those bad numbers. Different ways I could express this, but I'm just saying, let's consider all of the n's that doesn't make this true. All of the n's that make it false. Because this is a subset of the natural numbers, I can say, by the well-ordering principle, there is a smallest element of B. Call that element, what should we call it? Let's call it K. How about? So here I'm saying, all right, I want to think of all the things that make the theorem false. Because that's a subset of the natural numbers, the well-ordered principle tells me there's a smallest such one. So I think about the smallest number that makes this false. What's the smallest n that makes this expression false? And now what I'm going to do is try to derive a contradiction. I'm going to try to derive a contradiction with the claim that it's the smallest. So I'm going to try to show that if this is false for the smallest, then there's a smaller one for which it is also false. Okay? So I can say, because K is an element of B, it must be the case that the sum of I equals 1 to K of I does not equal K, K plus 1 over 2. I picked the smallest one that makes it false. Because it's one that makes it false, it must make it false. Okay? So I have that. This is given by how I picked my K. Now I want to show that it wasn't the smallest after all. So I'm just going to pick a number that is smaller and show that it also has to be false for that. So I'm going to say, how about let R equal K minus 1? Okay? So I'm going to say, all right, let's pick some number that's smaller than K. I'm going to pick just a little bit smaller than K because it's going to make my life a little easier, but I could pick otherwise. I can then say, because R is not an element of B, I know it's not an element of B because it's smaller than K, and K was the smallest element of B, so R can't be an element of B. Therefore, the theorem has to be true there. Okay, we're getting ready to make the contradiction, but I said a lot of things. Just take a moment, chat with your neighbor, make sure you agree that with all the things I've said, or if not, come up with a question of what I can clarify. Yes.
Why is it valid to assume that since R is not in B, so like we said that any element of B So why is it valid to assume that if the element is not in DNA, it will hold?
Great question.
I have sort of skipped a step of formally defining B. B is defined to be the set of X such that the theorem is false for X. Yes?
How do we know that R is still in a natural number?
Another excellent question. How could it not be in the natural numbers? Yeah, what if B includes zero? If B includes zero, then K would be zero, which would make the R negative, which would make this whole thing not work. Oh no, I better have an extra proof that shows K is not zero. Let's just quickly do that. We're just going to add off here on the margin. K is not equal to zero because, how do I know K is not equal to zero? Because the sum of I equals 1 to 0 of I is 0. This is actually by definition. The summation notation definition says that if the bottom is bigger than the top, I am summing nothing. There is nothing bigger, at least as big as 1 and at least as small as 0, so I am summing nothing else. So it's part of the definition of what's going on. So I can just show that K is not zero. It has to be bigger than that. And therefore, I could say, therefore, K is greater than zero. Therefore, R is an element of the natural numbers. So this is an important part of the proof. Questions about this or other questions? Okay. Let's come back to our main proof then. All right, now comes the time when we're going to play with fun arithmetic. So I'm going to stop trying to write prose. I'm just going to switch to just doing math notation. We're going to do several steps of algebra to make a contradiction appear. All right, because R is K minus 1, I can rewrite this as the sum from I equals 1 to K minus 1 of I equals K minus 1 K over 2. That's just substituting K minus 1 for R and simplifying the minus 1 plus 1 on the right hand side. Now I'm going to add to both sides the same value, which I'm allowed to do with algebra. And I'm going to pick a very specific value. I'm going to try to add in the value that was missing. So I'm going to add in k to both sides. I'm going to still have my sum from I equals 1 to k minus 1 of I, and it's still going to equal k minus 1 k over 2. I picked this because I want to turn this summation into this summation so that my equals and not equals can contradict. But they have different bounds, so I want to add in the extra term. Remember, this is a loop that sums k minus 1 things. This is a loop that sums k things. I'll add that k thing, and then they'll become the same. So I can take these two pieces here and turn them into just the sum of I equals 1 to k of I. I have something that sums up k minus 1, and then I have k, therefore I have summed up to k. And then on the other side, I can start doing some algebra. So I'm going to try to combine these. So now I'm going to have k minus 1, k plus 2k over 2, combining those terms. More algebra to do. I now need to figure out what that equals. So that is going to be k squared minus k plus 2k over 2, which is going to be equal to k squared plus k over 2, which is going to be equal to k plus 1.
over 2. And now I have a contradiction. This and this other half here, the sum of I equals 1 to K of I, these two things contradict. Questions about my algebra, playing around with summations? Anything here you'd like me to say more about? Yes?
How do you go from, like, the sum of R
to the sum of K?
Yeah.
Using this substitution here. Yep. Other questions? Yeah?
How did I
pick K? I wanted to turn my loop here into this loop.
Yes.
They differed by one term. One of them was 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus K minus 1. And the other one was 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus K minus 1 plus K. So I just added that extra K to make them look the same. Other questions? Meta comment on that. Often, when you're trying to prove things, what you're looking to do is make things look the same. So this idea of how do these two things differ, how can I make them look the same, is often a useful tool in proving all kinds of things. I mean, actually, as you continue in computing, you'll learn more and more strategies for doing that. In computational theory, there's this whole space called reductions that formalizes a vast space of how you make things look like each other. It's a very useful tool in lots of kinds of proofs. Other questions about this mathemagic? Okay, so my proof is getting big. Let's look at the whole thing. If I can get it all on the screen in a little smaller font. All right, so what did I do? I started by considering the set of everything that made it false. I knew that was a subset of the natural numbers, so I found the smallest one, which I knew wasn't 0, so there could be a number that's smaller than it. But I showed that number, if there is a number smaller than it, I have a contradiction. Because I started by assuming B had elements, and I ended by, I now have a contradiction, I can now use the rest of proof by contradiction. I can say, because assuming B had elements led to a contradiction. B must equal the empty set. The only subset of natural numbers that doesn't have a smallest element is the subset that has no elements at all. Okay? If B is the natural number, if it is the empty set, that means that this original statement, I equals 1 of n equals n minus 1 over 2, is true for all n in the natural numbers. Because the only way I can have a set defined as things that make it false be empty is if it's never false. And thus, I have completed my proof. Thoughts, comments, questions? This is probably, for most of you, this is probably an example of a proof that is too big to hold all of it in your head at once. This will commonly and increasingly be the case. Proofs of interesting theorems often have many steps. So often what you need to do when you're understanding a proof is convince yourself that each step works and that they all tie together. And then sometimes it's useful to give sort of a broad, overarching summary. Let's see if we can make a broad, overarching summary of this proof. Okay? Let's see if we can, instead of looking at the details, just summarize the big steps. The first step was I made a set of counterexamples. I defined this set that was everything that made the theorem false. Okay? I made a set of counterexamples. The next thing I did was I showed it has no smallest element. By assuming it did have a smallest element and deriving a contradiction. So I did this by contradiction. Yes?
What exactly does that mean? Like to say I have no smallest element?
If you show me an element, I can show you a smallest one that is also an element. No, what makes something an element of the set is it makes the theorem hold. Not hold. If you show me some particular n for which this is false, I can show you another one that's smaller. So if you show me, for example, that 538 makes this false, I can show you that 537 also makes it false. That did not satisfy you. How did I actually do this? I assumed I had the smallest thing that made it false, and I showed that contradicted the very nature of its existence. I showed that because it was the smallest thing that was false, the next smaller thing had to be true, but it wasn't. Right? I showed that assuming that R was true yielded a contradiction. So it means that R was also false. If K was false, R was false. If K doesn't work for the theorem, R doesn't work for the theorem, where R is one smaller than K. So if you show me any natural number that makes this false, I can show you another one, in particular, a smaller one. So if you say you have the smallest one that makes it false, I can show you you're wrong.
Why there's no disproven theorem in the first place?
Well, there's nothing that makes the theorem true. Well, I know there is because I proved that as a side. And we could pick other things to show it's true. I could just pick a few numbers. I could try one, I could try two, show that the theorem works. So I know there's something that makes it true. And if you show me anything that makes it false, we'll show you another smaller one, and this is a problem. Okay? And then, once I know there's no smallest, I can say because there's no smallest, falsifying element, there are none at all. Thus, it is true. It's the broad outline. There's different ways of writing this broad outline, but this is what I would see as sort of the main steps here. I did some sort of manipulation of my theorem. I took my theorem, and instead of trying to directly prove it true, I assumed there were some things that made it false, and then showed you that that was nonsensical. In particular, showed you there's no smallest thing that makes it false, but I know there has to be a smallest thing that makes it false, if there's any, and therefore that means there are none that make it false, so it must be true. Yes?
I'm a little confused with the R portion.
Yeah.
So going back to the previous question. So you were expecting R to be false?
I expected R to be true. Why did I expect R to be true? Because it was smaller than the smallest one that makes it false. So I assumed it was true. I assumed it was true right here. I wrote the theorem being true for R. I knew that had to be the case because it was smaller than K, and K was the smallest thing that makes it false.
Okay.
So what I used was the fact that K was false and R was true and showed those contradicted. Other questions? Okay. This is a really confusing way to prove something. Why would we do this? Induction would be so much cleaner. Well, for this particular case, induction will be cleaner. But there are things that we can't prove except by proof by contradiction. There are some really important theorems in computing. There are impossibility proofs, proofs that certain tasks cannot be done by computers, period. Those proofs can only be proven by proof by contradiction. And so part of the goal of this course is to ease you into those really important but complicated proofs by showing you the confusing aspect of the proof style and helping you become familiar and used to it before you get to the confusing theorems that the confusing proofs are talking about. So that once you get to them, hopefully they won't feel as confusing. Because a lot of our field is defined by some of these impossibility proofs, proving that things can't happen. And they tend to have this general structure as a proof by contradiction. So we're going to give you multiple exposures to that to try to warm you up to it. All right. My plan now is to give you several smaller, simpler proofs by contradiction, and then we'll talk a little about what we'll do on Friday. Before I do that, any other questions about this proof? Okay. Let's try several smaller, simpler proofs by contradiction. One half is not an integer. Did we do this one on Monday? Okay. Then, if we did this on Monday, we've talked about proof by contradiction, take a moment, turn to where you're sitting next to you, see if you can summarize this proof without looking it up. How would you go about doing this proof? We've done it before, we've talked about the strategy, see how far you can get. Or things you want me to talk about that came out of this brief review? All right, let me try to give a sort of a high-level outline of what we do. We assume X as a member of the integers where X is equal to 1/2, which means that 2X is equal to 1. And then we use the fundamental theorem of arithmetic to show that 2 is a factor of 2x, which means 2 is a factor of 1, which is false. Ergo, there is no such x element of the integers where x is equal to 1/2, which means that 1/2 is not an element of the integers. It's not quite the structure we used before, but generally it still follows the basic structure of proof by contradiction and has most of the pieces we want. Questions about this outline, other ways of going about it, other questions about this proof? Yes?
Isn't the fundamental theorem of arithmetic for
natural
numbers?
It is. So, the fundamental theorem of arithmetic works for natural numbers. What is the difference between natural numbers and integers? They can be negative. Is this number negative? Therefore, is this number negative? Therefore, is this number negative? And I'm in business. Even if some of them were negative, I could just multiply by -1 and make that problem go away. Other questions? Okay, let's take a similar but somewhat more complicated. The square root of 2, we usually don't write the 2, I suppose. We're going to try to prove that the square root of 2 is not rational.
Okay, this proof is going to have a similar structure to the last one we just did. It's going to be a bit more complicated, though. Okay, so we're going to again sort of assume that the square root of 2 is a natural number,
or a rational number, rather.
If the square root of 2 was a rational number, that means that there has to exist some x and y in the integers such that x divided by y equals the square root of 2. Because rational numbers are defined as the ratio of two integers, so we can do this. We can actually say more things than this. We can also say that the greatest common divisor of xy is equal to 1. Because all rational numbers can be written in what's called lowest terms, or simplified form, okay? Canonical form. There's different names for this. We can actually also argue that y is greater than or equal to 1 if we really want to. There always exists, for every rational number, a ratio of integers that are coprime, that have no shared roots, no shared factors either, and where the denominator is positive. Questions about this claim? All right. Now we have this existential thing. We don't want the existential thing, so we're just going to ignore it and not tell you what x and y is. Use existential instantiation. Remember, when we do this, we are not allowed to make any claims about x or y. Because it's merely existential, we don't know which one exists, so we can't pick the one we want. We just say, all right, x divided by y equals square root of 2. That means that x equals y times the square root of 2, which means that x squared equals y squared times 2. Any questions about my arithmetic, since we haven't used square roots in this class, and I don't know how many years it's been since you last dealt with these things? Okay. Now I need to get a contradiction. Where does the contradiction come from in having this sentence? The answer has to do, there's several ways of wording this. One of the simplest is to say that x squared has an even multiplicity of 2s in its factorization. Remember that every number has a prime factorization, a unique prime factorization. And if I square something, then I end up with doubling the multiplicity of each of those factors. So if x has no 2s, the next squared has 0 2s. If x has 1 2, the next squared has 2 2s. If x has 2 2s, the next squared has 4 2s. However many 2s x has, x squared has twice that many, that is to say it has an even number. The same is also true of y squared. Because it's squared, it also has to have an even number. Which means that 2y squared has an odd number, an odd multiplicity of 2s in its prime factorizations. And I can't have a number that has an even number on one side and an odd number on the other, hence my contradiction, and the rest of the proof follows. Questions? Yes? Yes. Remember when we talked about how 60 can be written as 2 times 2 times 3 times 5? And we said that can also be written as 2 squared times 3 to the 1 times 5 to the 1. The multiplicity is that thing there. And also the 1s are also multiplicities. Other questions? Yeah. Why does 2y squared have an odd number of 2s? Well, y squared has an even number. If I add another 2, now it has an odd number.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So why do y squared and x squared not have an even amount?
Because I squared them. Right? So in particular, let's suppose that x, I don't know, let's just say it was 2 to the k times w. Then therefore, x squared is that times itself, which means it's 2 to the 2k times w squared. And 2k is an even number, whatever k was. Yes?
How do we know that x squared and y squared have 2 as a factor?
They might not. 0 is still even. So I'm allowed to say, what is the multiplicity of 7s in 60? That's right. So I can always ask what the multiplicity of a factor is, any factor I pick. It might be 0, but I can always ask that multiplicity. Other questions? So the rest of the proof would then go to say, all right, we've derived a contradiction. We have two things are equal. One is an odd number of twos. The other is an even number of twos. That is a contradiction. Therefore, a thing we assumed, that square root of 2 is rational, must be false. And I have this written out in more detail on the course website as well. Let me do one more, and then we'll talk about other things. There does not exist a smallest x in R plus. Let's just remind ourselves, because I told you what it means and we haven't used it yet. What does R plus mean? Sorry? It's the positive real numbers, the reals that are positive. And I'm telling you, there's no smallest positive real number. Okay? So, let's assume that k is the smallest positive real number. I'm just going to assume that k is. And then I'm going to derive a contradiction, which tells me that k must not exist, which means there must not be a smallest positive real number. Okay? The way I'm going to get to a contradiction is show there's one even smaller. Okay? So let's first say things about k. Then k is greater than 0. How do I know k is greater than 0? Because it's an element of a set of positive numbers. So they all are greater than 0. Then let's consider k divided by 2. If I take a positive number and divide it by 2, it becomes smaller. K divided by 2 is smaller than k because k is greater than 0. So I have found a smaller number than k. I also need to show that it's greater than 0. K divided by 2 is greater than 0 because k is greater than 0. You divide two positive numbers, you end up with a positive number. And k divided by 2 is an element of the reals because, what do we want to say? The reals are closed under division. Dividing two reals gives me another real. Therefore, k divided by 2 is a smaller element of the positive reals than its smallest, which is a contradiction. Yes?
Can you repeat what you mean by closed under?
Yeah, so closed under is a term that we actually only introduced in practice for the sets lab, but closed under means if you give me an operation and a set, if you apply that operation to members of the set, you get another member of the set. So if you divide two real numbers, you get a real number. I should really say that R plus is closed under, because you can't divide by zero and remain real. But I am in R plus, so I'm good to go. Other questions? All right. This general strategy of proving things by contradiction. You state the opposite of what you're trying to prove, and then you try to show that it doesn't work. If you're saying something is smallest, you show there's a smaller one. If you say something doesn't exist, then something exists, you try to show there's a contradiction in that, often with the well-ordering principle. If you're trying to show that some equivalence holds, you try to show that the set of things which it holds doesn't work. Okay? Different ways of going about this. And for that, I have written the longest practice I have written yet. Okay, I want to give you plenty of opportunity to practice this if you want. So, we start with just some convert to prose, some basic logic, because it's worth reiterating that. We have a few fill-in-the-blanks about prime factorization. Huzzah. Okay, these will hopefully be somewhat easier. And then we have proof that 2/3 is not an integer, that square root of 2 is not rational. Turn this symbolic proof into a prose proof, where we have a proof by contradiction of 5/3 not being an integer. We have a prose proof of the cube root of 4 not being rational that you're to turn into prose as well. We have some things where you can prove with symbols or rationals and some various aspects of how this works. And then, in case you're interested, we have another 21 things you can try proving. Okay? Now, clearly not all of these will be on the quiz. But I would encourage you to look at this. Let me just comment briefly. There's different kinds of them. Problem 18 is probably one of the harder ones, but it is a popular one. You can find people who've walked through it online and so forth. We also have things like prove there is no longest running two-argument function that does addition, which are not mathy at all. We just want you to like talk through the process of contradiction outside of the math space. So, a variety of different things you can practice on as you move forward. Before I close, we've got 3 minutes. I can walk through an example of one of these. I can talk some more about some of them. Any questions, thoughts, comments you have about what's gone on so far? All right. Let me just pick one of these that is unlike ones we've done before and sort of start you down the road here. Let's take this one, 28. Prove there is no largest two-argument function f of xy that returns x plus y in the programming language of your choice. Do this by showing that if there was a largest program, you make a larger one that has the same behavior. Okay? So I'm going to show there's no biggest addition function. I can always make a bigger addition function. So let's go about how we would do this. Let's sort of think through this process. Okay? So our theorem is there is no largest addition function. And our proof is going to be assume there is a largest. After I assume there's largest, what's the next thing I should do? I assume something exists. I virtually always want to give it a name. So let's say, let C be the code of that function. Giving it a name allows me to build something off of it. I now need a longer function that also does addition. How can I make a longer function than an unknown gargantuan function that does addition? Any ideas of what I could do here? Yeah? I can add zero. Okay, so I'm going to say define C prime to be C except the return whatever is replaced by return that same thing plus zero. Hooray! Hey, two extra characters. It's bigger than the one we had before. It's trivially bigger. It's not interestingly bigger, but it is bigger. And since I assume this is as big as I can get, I have now made one that's bigger. There are lots of other ways you could do this, okay? But this is the general approach you're going through for a proof by contradiction. So I will see you all on Friday.